Keep It is brought to you by One of Them Days. All right, y'all, listen up. We got a movie that's about to light up your weekend. The new, hilarious, and outrageous R-rated comedy, One of Them Days, hits movie theaters Thursday. Trust me, One of Them Days is a comedy you do not want to miss. From the brilliant mind of producer Issa Rae and starring the dynamic duo of Kiki Palmer and SZA, yes, you heard me right, SZA on the big screen, so you can turn off Lana and go ahead and see her at the movies. It's a hilarious buddy comedy that'll have you laughing, cheering, and maybe even tearing up a little. Ride or Die best friends and odd couple roommates, Drew, played by Kiki Palmer, and Alyssa, played by SZA, discover Alyssa's boyfriend has blown their rent money. Now it's a race against the clock as the duo finds themselves in crazy situations one after another to avoid getting evicted, all while keeping their friendship intact. One of Them Days is the funniest, most outrageous comedy we've all been waiting for. It's serving up all the vibes, unfiltered, unapologetic, and absolutely unforgettable. Grab your friends, grab your snacks, and get ready to laugh. Early screenings have brought the house down with the entire audience laughing out loud, okay? Nobody's brought the house down since Queen Latifah and Steve Martin, so you know this must be good. There's scenes that you'll be talking about for days. One of Them Days, exclusively in movie theaters Thursday. Rated R. Get your tickets now. And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I am a frazzled Louis Vertel. Back from, I'm going to call it the trenches. By that, I mean just Los Angeles. The most treacherous week in my 16 years. Now 16 years, literally. Almost to the day. I moved to LA. I have never once, like, observed the terrain of LA and felt anything but, you know, like I'm at home here. And, you know, it's just a completely cursed, strange, new for me feeling here in LA, even though it seems like we are beta testing every version of the apocalypse in LA at some point or another. This past week it was fire, which was just unreal. That continues to be unreal, as I'm sure you all know. And it's hard to have anything to say about it because it just feels like we're not on the other side of it yet.
How's it feel to be Martha Gellhorn for the day?
Wow. I've so generally identified with other Nicole Kidman characters. People forget that she played Gellhorn in some, was a TV movie? Who played Hemingway? I don't even remember it.
Clive Owen.
Clive Owen. Wow. We paired them together.
She's been paired with everybody at this point.
I think I've said it before. I think she is the most employed person in the history of show business.
If you are waiting to star opposite Nicole Kidman, stay in line.
Yeah, it's basically everyone now. She's like the new Kevin Bacon times 10.
No, it's nice to hear that you're doing well and that you escaped from LA like Kurt Russell and went to San Diego for a bit. So now you're back. And I don't know, how does it feel in the city? You know, I feel like I personally, not having lived in LA for a few years now, it's whatever you think about the city, your mind immediately goes to, you know, sort of Hollywood and the film industry, and having worked in it, you know, that's what both of us think about. But I think that this week has really just sort of reminded people that there's so much more going on in Los Angeles than Hollywood.
Yeah, even though it's this big pseudo-disconnected stream of pseudo-suburbs in LA, things like this remind you that you actually do live in a community. When we had Nithya Raman here years ago, it was one of those aha moments where I realized this is a real place. Like, real people mm-hmm. live here and communicate with each other every day. And it's not just, you know, this place we deposit all of our ambitions and hope for the best, like one big, you know, lotto ticket community or something. And so to get all these updates, specifically from local news in LA, being really fabulous over the past week as it pertained to the fires and continuing warnings and stuff. It's like slightly altered what I think about living here. And I hate to use the word warmth during a time like this, but there is a warmth to realizing the level of conscience happening in the community.
Local news, but not the LA Times. Let's just point that out.
Oh, no. I would describe myself as pissed at them.
Yeah. I would describe it as warmth as well. You know, you can sort of feel it even here on the East Coast. You know, I feel like it's nice seeing people that I love in Los Angeles sort of helping out in any way that I can. It was devastating to hear a lot of friends who had either lost homes or their parents had lost homes, lost family homes. And I think people in New York, too, are sort of, we're usually like, fuck LA here. But a lot of people have been setting up clothing drives. A lot of people have been donating money. I think that a lot of people have just really been sort of finding any way that they can support Los Angeles. And yeah, it is a city of a bunch of disconnected suburbs that were originally connected by rail. And now it's just sort of connected by the main thing in Los Angeles is sort of the highway. You're just driving from communities. And I think you spend a lot of time in cars alone in that city. And this week, seeing people embrace other people from different communities and driving to Altadena, you know, to donate or sort of help out has been, it seems like a city coming together.
I mean, even reading Sally Field wrote on Instagram that she was born and raised in Altadena. Then she now currently lives in the Palisades. So it's like the entire breadth of her amazing life has been affected in the past week by all of this. And just to be acquainted with the fact that, oh yeah, people are born here. That alone is like something that I have to tell myself because it doesn't feel like that. You know, everybody here is, you know, Louis Fertel, like traipsing in with their bindle from the suburbs of Chicago and, you know, hoping to write on the SAGs one day.
From Allentown.
You really should see me hoof. I can bring it.
People from Allentown move to 42nd Street right. In New York. Chicagoans go to L.A.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, where else do Chicagoans go? Minnesota? I mean, like, it feels like we don't have that many options. It's either one of the coasts or the other.
Yeah. It has been nice seeing stories of different communities coming out of L.A. First of all, because I feel like a lot of the stories immediately were, look at these celebrities whose homes burned down. Uh-huh. And I'm like, okay. I mean, I feel bad for them, obviously, but these are the people who will be able to either A, rebuild their homes very quickly, or two, have the money to just relocate somewhere else while their home is being rebuilt, or just completely move somewhere else, you know?
Mm-hmm. Though I will say, not that I am hoping for this kind of thing for anybody, but in a way, well, it's sort of like, you know, when a notable celebrity gets like a disease people don't know about, well, then people remember it. You know what I mean? So it's like, in a way, like the fact that there are so many faces put to this particular disaster, like cements the moment in time. And I don't want to say I'm happy about anything that is happening right now. It's like, oh, now it's like when Tom Hanks got COVID. It's like, oh, now something is really activated. Like, I know who that is. It happened to him. And now that means maybe, you know, more people will help or something, you know. So it's shocking how many people this has affected. Like our past guest, Mandy Moore, I believe she just lost her house.
She did.
Among other people, like, you know, it happens to not just friends of us, like James Woods, like any version of a celebrity it can happen to. So that,
thank God.
He is, you know, he did film a movie in my hometown called Straight Talk with Dolly Parton. And everybody was extremely excited to meet Dolly Parton and not James Woods. And I want to call that progressive liberal action in my hometown. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that is a good reminder that the lens through which we learn about a lot of things in the world in general is through pop culture, and it's through celebrities, for better or worse, you know? So a celebrity getting something like COVID, a celebrity losing their home is something that just sort of reminds people who aren't generally thinking about other people that something has happened. You know, we don't tend to think about our neighbors all the time, but you might remember that the celebrity lost a home. And so then you might remember that, oh, other people, you know, are affected by this. I mean, I recall maybe our first episode of Keep It, you know, where 1991, where you were talking about Rock Hudson getting AIDS, you know, you were just happy that people knew about the disease.
That's what I screamed. Yes. No, I mean, it's like, I mean, the reason people know the word anorexia is because of Karen Carpenter. People are constantly, whether or not they even mean to, adding to the Wikipedia file in their head of information about certain celebrities. And so when something like this happens, it's like meaningful. It like affects the brain in a particular way. So it is an unbelievably treacherous time. Again, I've lived here so long. I consider myself, I am a Los Angeles resident. And that the fact that I feel it's such an unprecedented time should tell you this is a completely whack moment. So,
yeah, I think this morning I was already hearing reports of the Grammys are going ahead as a disaster relief effort, and they're obviously canceling all of the parties surrounding the Grammys because it feels insensitive in this moment. And I believe that Jean Smart has been making calls to, you know, sort of cancel award season, etc. But I think that someone brought up a very good point. I think it was Mark Mulkin on the news, actually, about how a lot of the city isn't just obviously the celebrities who are a part of Hollywood, but a lot of the city does rely on those celebrities and the industry and their red carpets and everything to pay their bills. Mm-hmm. And if you've lost your home or you've had to evacuate, I mean, it's, was it double homicide at this point, you know, if you also don't have work to go to?
Right. But also, it's like, I don't really just love characterizing award shows as self-congratulatory. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. That to me feels shallow. I feel like that's a perception we're constantly combating. I think there's artistic merit to them. And also, it's like, is it really any more or less merited than any sporting event? I'm just saying.
It feels like
nobody is ever questioning the sanctity of that. And it's always award shows where, you know, a woman might be honored that is considered a vainglorious event.
Also, self-congratulatory, maybe if you have 20 of them at home, you know, but for a Divine Joy Randolph, like last season, who is getting her first major award, and that will lead to, I don't know, her getting more work. It will also lead towards other Black women getting more work. I think awards are very vital.
Yeah. No, I mean, and also I've decided I am into this Oscar season. I thought it was maybe a season low on prestige, you know, turnout. But after seeing like The Brutalist, after seeing Sing Sing, I think there's a lot going on here. I'm rooting for Zoe Saldana in the supporting categories. So we have a lot to hash out this season. I think it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, but you still haven't seen Venom the Last Dance, so you're really not there yet.
I'm not a real moviegoer. I'm not what you call a cinephile.
Well, speaking of cinephiles, I think that this week is the perfect week to just talk about Los Angeles in general. So for this week, we're just going to talk about our favorite Los Angeles movies where Los Angeles is a character.
I, by the way, was shocked not to have an immediate answer to this question. So to hash it out and figure out what the hell we actually want out of an LA movie, whether we want it to be real or surreal or what, I think will be very helpful to me.
Yes. And then I have a very surreal interview with Robbie Williams to discuss his surreal film, Better Man, which is a biopic of his life starring a CGI monkey.
Now, let me tell you something. I saw this movie, too. I thought I would be doing this interview, and then I couldn't make it last minute. See this movie. I mean, I remain provoked by this film. It was also entertaining, and they really make a centerpiece out of the song Rock DJ, which is the definitive Robbie Williams jam and video.
Yeah, I would say that for me, it's jarring at first seeing a monkey playing Robbie Williams, but it starts out in his childhood and then moves on to adulthood. So you see this monkey growing older. And honestly, it got tears out of me in the end. I think like I eventually just started seeing the monkey as a real character.
And also you question like, so why is this a monkey? Like nobody's explaining this to you. It just happens on screen. And then as it goes on, the way other monkeys appear in the movie, it's interesting. It's interesting. I'm curious what more other people think of it.
And it's from the director of The Greatest Showman. So you know that like the musical numbers are fun and dazzling. And it's if you love musicals, you'll enjoy this.
Do you think that guy also directed Hugh Jackman and Sutton Foster walking down the street in Santa Monica? Because, baby, that was staged.
Shout out, by the way, to these two Broadway stars having their stage shoot in Santa Monica.
Yeah, that is a borderline a betrayal. I mean, how could they do such a thing?
Which is how you know it's staged because they've been fucking living in New York. So wouldn't you have seen them being papped or something, you know, walking through the city or at a restaurant, etc. They've been keeping this on the low until they were ready to announce. Conveniently timed with, Younger appearing on Netflix.
Wow. Oh, no, not promo for this. Do you think Debbie Mazar's behind this?
This goes all the way to the top. And okay. By the top, I mean the top of the hills in Bel Air where Darren Star lives.
Those hills are just massive, as you know.
Yeah. I worked there briefly. That is my favorite. I don't know if I really talked about it on the show, but that was maybe my favorite writer's room experience. It was 2021, you know, a lot of the rooms were closed, a lot of people were working on Zoom, and we worked in Darren's backyard of his Bel Air mansion.
Was this for Uncoupled?
Uncoupled.
Oh, got it. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. Anyway, Hugh and Sutton, maybe they sing Mary and the Librarian when they're getting down. Who knows? 76 trombones in my ass or whatever. Anyway, sorry.
Hugh, do the boy from Oz. You know how that gets me, Randy.
Oh, yes. Right. He's a Tony winner, too. Anyway. Too many Tonys in that relationship.
Tony.
Yes. It never rains in Southern California except when they're fucking. Anyway, that was my Tony joke. Sorry.
All right. When we're back, more Keep It. Keep It is brought to you by Lumen.
Did you know 80% of resolutions fail by February? You can beat the odds with Lumen and improve your health. Lumen is the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device that measures your metabolism through your breath. And on the app, it lets you know if you're burning fat or carbs and gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, workouts, sleep, and even stress management.
All you have to do is breathe, just like Michelle Branch told you to.
No, I believe that was Anna Nalick. Moving on.
You breathe into your Lumen first thing in the morning, and you'll find out what's going on with your metabolism, whether you're burning mostly fats or carbs. And then Lumen gives you a personalized nutrition plan for that day based on your measurements.
You can also breathe into it before and after workouts and meals so you know exactly what's going on in your body in real time. And Lumen will give you tips to keep you on top of your health game. I also say this is valuable for me because I am somebody who, sorry, I'm about to start crying. My body doesn't want to gain a lot of weight. And so knowing what my metabolism is up to helps me improve when it comes to building muscle. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to get so emotional.
Your metabolism is your body's engine. It's how your body turns the food you eat into fuel that keeps you going. Because your metabolism is at the center of everything your body does, optimal metabolic health translates to a bunch of benefits, including easier weight management, improved energy levels, better fitness results, better sleep, etc. And Lumen also gives you recommendations to improve your metabolic health. It can also track your cycle as well as the onset of menopause, Lewis. So,
oh,
there you go.
Slay.
And it can adjust your recommendations to keep your metabolism healthy through hormonal shifts so you can keep up your energy and stave off cravings.
So if you want to keep the weight off for good this year, go to lumen.me/keepit to get 20% off your Lumen.
That's lumen.me/keepit for 20% off your purchase. Thank you, Lumen, for sponsoring this episode.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Whether you're experiencing the fires firsthand in LA or watching on TV or on your phone, it hurts to see the city in such despair. So to celebrate Los Angeles the only way we know how, through obscure references and other trivia, Ira and I put together a curated list of all our favorite movies and TV shows that scream LA. Now, you may have mentioned TV shows. I just did movies because, as you know, I believe TV is entertainment and movies are art.
I mean, listen, we're going to talk about movies in this segment, but I will say that as far as TV shows, and a lot of TV shows set in LA are usually just cop shows.
Right.
You know, like, I will say that the two that come to mind are, one, The Closer.
Oh, sure. Kira. I remember we gave her an Emmy at the very last minute for that. That was so unexpected. That's like one of the few times I've ever been shocked at the Emmys.
The thing about The Closer, too, is that her character, Brenda Lee Johnson, moves to L.A. from Atlanta. And so she has no idea how to get around in Los Angeles. And this is pre-using, like, Waze or your smartphone while she's trying to navigate the city. So she is constantly getting lost in the first season of The Closer, just trying to navigate her way to different places in LA. So that's fun. You really get to see the city.
Yeah.
And I will also say there's this new show on ABC that I recently got obsessed with called High Potential, starring Caitlin Olsen.
Oh, I've only seen a little bit of it, but I'm loving it so far.
I love her. I really just turned it on after I watched the Abbott Elementary It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia crossover, which was actually hilarious and reminded me that I have not watched It's Always Sunny in forever. And Caitlin Olsen, her new show was just auto-playing right after that episode. So thanks, Hulu. And it's a show that sort of, I feel like cop shows in general are the one thing that get into the different communities in Los Angeles that aren't just Hollywood, you know, because it has to be sprawling just sort of by nature.
Which reminds me, I feel like my favorite LA set TV show, and this is kind of cheating because the main house of the show is here. And the show, I believe, if you check a piece of mail in one episode, says it takes place in California, but gelling those facts together, I'm going to say this is an LA set show. The Wonder Years, the original one with Fred Savage, is technically, I believe, an LA suburb. And I like that as an LA show because, one, nothing about it screams like the industry or whatever. It could take place anywhere. And I mean, in America, basically, it looks kind of like it could be Iowa or it could be the Northeast or whatever. And I like that California can also have a humdrum anywhere in America suburbia vibe, in addition to being, you know, the larger-than-life place we see in movies like La La Land or whatever. I also just want to say in general about The Wonder Years, and I'm sure I've said this before, the fact that they added just narration to make this everyday kid's life, the decisions he makes in his life have meaning and import, made it so touching. This show is so amazingly touching and never had a bad episode. And because half of the show is you're waiting for them to get through the narration and they're just standing there in, you know, these characters are just standing around while narration occurs, you get these moments that seem actually realer than an actual TV show because people are standing around not saying anything and not furthering a plot. So it feels like you're getting this slice of life thing in addition to witty commentary done by Daniel Stern. I remain a stan of that show. And I feel like more people would like the original if they got to see it. That's like, that was the benefit of watching Nick at Night when we were in like middle school. Like they played The Wonder Years nonstop.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of narration, when I think of Los Angeles in film, I really think of film noir immediately.
Oh, of course.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. I hear Walter Neff in Double Indemnity.
That's got
to
be the best one.
Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And noir was really just a genre that I feel like got into the grittier neighborhoods of Los Angeles, you know, the parts that had lower income housing and sort of the outskirts of the city in general.
No, I mean, when you watch Double Indemnity, as I saw it recently, first of all, you get Barbara Stanwyck giving one of her signature performances. You get Fred McMurray also giving one of his signature performances and having the lanterniest of lantern jaws. I mean, if any Martin Landau bitch, you don't even compare. Step off. You get a lot of descriptions of actual LA geography in here. I believe they're in the Los Feliz area for a lot of the movie. And it's so weird to watch a movie from 1944 and recognize the place you live in. Like, New York is a city. Like, any movie that looks like a city will kind of look like New York. This looks like the specifics of Los Angeles, from the hills of that area to when you get down into, like, the Franklin Avenue, Vermont region. It's really surprising. It's surprising that anything kind of holds up from that time and seems recognizable.
Well, to really shoot Los Angeles in a film, too, you sort of have to be someone who kind of loves the city or lives there, because I think that New York, as you said, is immediately recognizable. And New York itself is cinematic. You set up a camera anywhere in New York City, it feels like New York City. You can sort of frame it because of the buildings, because, you know, like if you just stand in the street, you can see all, you can see far, you can see the Empire State Building, etc. Like it feels like New York. Even a random street corner in the East Village, it's going to feel like New York City, you know? A large swath of Los Angeles, I'm sorry, are ugly and uncinematic, you know? And so you really have to specifically know where to shoot in Los Angeles to make it, one, recognizable as Los Angeles, and two, make it feel anything like a love letter to the city.
Yeah. There are a number of 70s movies that I think really capture LA the same way that 70s is the heyday for New York movies. First of all, there's, of course, Chinatown, which is the aesthetic of 70s, 40s, just in general, in movies as typified by The Godfather, etc. Fabulous. But my favorite L.A. movie, which is from the 70s, is Shampoo, which stars Warren Beatty as this Lothario hairdresser based allegedly on John Peters, the former lover of Barbara Streisand and husband of my girl, Leslie Ann Warren. And he is this, you know, he's messing around with Goldie Hawn. He's messing around with Julie Christie. He's messing around with Academy Award winner Lee Grant in her maybe signature role on film. But to me, the best thing about this movie, and it takes place around Election Day in 1968, even though the movie was made in 1975. It gets how long it takes in L.A. to get from place to place. You'll be at a restaurant, and then you see the people wait outside the restaurant for a cab. Then they're in the cab, and there's a scene in the cab. Then they finally get to this party. The passage of time in L.A. as you're trying to get from one place to another over a single night is inherently epic. And this is one of the few movies that really gets that. And also, you get a sense of glamour in this movie because a lot of it takes place in the hills, too. Another Warren Beatty movie that gets a lot of action out of the hills is Heaven Can Wait. I'm not a stan of Heaven Can Wait. I do love the shape of Julie Christie's hair, of course. But Shampoo, I prefer.
One of the greatest film posters. I love the Heaven Can Wait film poster.
Oh, yeah. I love the Shampoo poster with Warren Beatty holding the scissors over Goldie Hawn and Julie Christie. By the way, all of Goldie Hawn's 70s movies remain historically so underrated now. If you haven't seen Butterflies or Free recently, she is fucking hilarious in it and says something so mean about lesbians.
I should see that movie then, because I'm always saying mean things about lesbians, meaning my sister. Anyway, Warren Beatty, let's just say that that was a man, a white man, with lips.
Oh,
and
please.
When we are...
There's about six of them all together. You'll notice I am not one of them. Yes.
When you are praising so many of the young leading white men these days, let's start praising some men with lips, okay? Warren Beatty was a man. You look at Paul Newman, this is a man, okay? None of the men right now that everyone is fawning over are evoking the heat that Warren Beatty does. I'm just going to say that.
Well, I mean, I say this appreciatively about Timothée Chalamet, but his lips are two other clavicles on his body. As you know, I believe he's like six clavicles altogether. It's his full exoskeleton.
If you want to also talk about films that really get the passage of time in LA, even if there's sort of a lie about how quick it takes to get places in Los Angeles, you got to mention Clueless.
Oh, please. First of all,
everywhere in LA takes 20 minutes? I don't think so. Maybe when that movie was made, but LA could borrow from New York and add some congestion pricing.
Yes.
And then maybe you could get places in 20 minutes.
I mean, like Clueless, I can't even pick a favorite LA location. First of all, I mean, it also is a toast to mall culture, which I think is like now a lost American problem. But at the time, just... the way they walk through the city. I'm just like the self-absorption and yet flavorfulness of the characters. P.S. Obviously, Letterboxd is doing the work of the gods by asking all these celebrities what their four favorite movies are. They asked Nicole Kidman recently. She jumped to say Clueless. What a good moment for humanity. And then she said The Piano Teacher. Yes.
I also think she said The Piano.
Yes, and The Piano. Right. So you're getting some females at work here.
That bitch is tickling the ivories at home. I know that.
You're talking about Keith Urban, that bitch.
I think you said you could come up with a favorite LA moment in Clueless, but for me, immediately, the first thing that comes to mind is Cher getting robbed outside the circus.
The Aaliyah. Lifters.
Yeah. Get on the ground, please. It's an Aaliyah. That is cinema. Every time I used to drive by that Circus Liquors, that scene jumped into my brain.
Ugh, no. I mean, it's painful how good that movie is. We of course, had a famous feud, not you and I, on this show about whether Clueless or Mean Girls was superior. And I feel like it's those moments.
It's,
you know, the not just the time of Clueless, but the place of it that make it superior.
Well, speaking of one of our famous Keep It feuds, you know what movie I'm going to bring up that I love and you hate.
Oh, my God. I was going to say it's the Blues Brothers, movie. But that's Chicagoan. A movie I hate, La La Land. I like it well enough.
L.A. Confidential.
Oh, it's not that I hate it. I just don't love the Best Supporting Actress win. I mean, I do like that in the movie, the character says, "You're the only man who hasn't compared me to Veronica Lake in 2 seconds." And then he responds, "You look better than Veronica Lake," or whatever the line is. That is and also, by the way, really enjoy Guy Pearce in that movie. And I also love him in The Brutalist, a movie that I have two problems with, but he is back, baby.
What are the two problems?
Have you seen it yet?
I haven't seen it yet. We'll talk about it next week.
Okay, yeah. This, put a pin in this. But no, LA Confidential is the rare movie of, I was watching it once in my apartment. I've probably seen that movie four times. And at one point, they're at the a street in LA, and they run across the street literally to where my apartment is. It's a movie you can watch in LA, and then it will simply be happening to you. It's like an immersive experience.
It's like Teen Beach Movie from Disney. You're in the movie.
Yes. That's what they were going for. Yes.
When I think of LA movies too, you always think of the big landmarks, the architecture. I'm always thinking of, for instance, John Lautner. Architecture, and that brings to mind The Big Lebowski, Body Double, the Why Do Fools Fall in Love?
I'm sure. Yes. You know what I actually kind of appreciate is when a movie is lower key but still takes place in LA. Like, it's not making hay of like the epicness of the iconography of LA. This is not in my top LA movies, but I appreciate a movie like 500 Days of Summer. That, like, just is in the city, looks like L.A., and it is a character in the movie, but it's not, we're not meant to be sort of in the thrall of L.A.
13, for instance.
Oh, my God. Great L.A. movie. How many times can I bring up the movie 13? I want to also shout out my friend, Peter Christian, who can quote every line of the movie 13. I literally make him do it at parties. He'll do the entire movie for me.
Speaking of the 70s, it's set in the 70s, but it's a modern film. It's The Nice Guys.
Never seen it.
Nice Guys. It's a movie that people are constantly begging for a sequel to, just sort of like The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Now, by the way, in the
which could happen because Armie Hammer's back, baby.
Oh, yeah. What is he, like the most successful podcaster of all time now or whatever? Like, when Hawk to a Girl just arrived and decided to be the world's greatest podcaster, I'm like, how did this happen? Who made this choice?
Armie will be on Keep It next week, so we can discuss that with him then.
Okay, great. That's so exciting for him. Okay, there's a movie that I actually want to categorically eliminate from the consideration of best L.A. movie, because while it takes place in L.A., has geography in the title, I think it exists in a world that has nothing to do with real L.A., and you also don't get a real glimpse at L.A., and my answer is Mulholland Drive. Now, I've seen this movie recently. Obviously, it is a one-of-a-kind achievement. Just along the lines of, the performances are that David Lynch thing of, is this good? And then sometimes they're really compelling, and then awkward on purpose, and then obviously there's a dream logic to the movie. And what I think is most impressive about the movie is, it's like you can sense the person who's having these dreams waking up at the end, because things are becoming a little bit more coherent, and you can things are starting to feel a little bit more real, gelled. It's just obviously an impressive movie. I don't think you get any actual L.A. out of it.
People always bring up Mulholland Drive, but I think the underrated film in his catalog that's set in L.A. is Lost Highway.
Which I haven't seen in probably 25 years.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I rewatched it when we had Patricia Arquette on the show.
How do you feel about Quentin Tarantino's movies as they pertain to LA from Pulp Fiction down to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Do you think he has a definitive LA moment in movies?
Well, you know I'm a Tarantini. Okay.
Oh, you like it stirred and shaken. I didn't know that.
I am always doing the dance from Pulp Fiction.
Okay. Wow.
Actually, that's how Lewis dances.
I'm going to say I am white. So that is like a possibility for me.
I love Tarantino films. You know, I really, really enjoyed Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. I do love the LA Cafe from Pulp Fiction, though. I mean, the one you always pass on, I believe, Wilshire, is it? That, to me, is just a very scenic. And one of those things that, like, somebody who grew up in L.A. would seek out and put in movies because you, for some reason, don't see that commercial district of L.A. in movies ever.
Yeah. If we want to talk about a part of L.A. that really doesn't get put on film that much anymore, but heavily, like, in the 90s and early 2000s, you know, I want to talk about South Central Los Angeles. I'm thinking about Friday. I'm thinking about Boys in the Hood. I'm thinking about Menace to Society, Baby Boy. Like, that is a part of LA that we really don't see on film that much anymore, but there was just this explosion of, you know, films from young Black filmmakers in the 90s.
I guess Boys in the Hood would still be the definitive movie from that area, wouldn't it? I'm trying to think of anything otherwise. By the way,
Angela Bassett,
please.
We will be right back with more about Los Angeles in film.
Keep It is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol.
I don't bounce back the next day like I used to. I have to make a choice. I can either have a great night or a great next day. That is, until I found pre-alcohol.
ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Did you hear me? Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow.
This feels like an adult episode of The Magic School Bus.
Yeah, Miss Frizzle being like, listen here, Ralphie. If you throw up on the curb outside the school one more fucking time.
I actually really do like ZBiotics. It's in my fridge right now. Currently, I am in the midst of dry January, but also some people are doing damp January where they're having a light drink here and there.
Damp is simply a horrible word used in this case, and I'm sorry you brought it up.
But every time I have pre-alcohol before drinks, I notice a difference the next day. Even after a night out, I can confidently plan on recording this podcast without worry.
Go to zbiotics.com/keepit to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use Keep It at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/keepit and use the code KEEPIT at checkout for 15% off.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And we're back.
Another part of LA that I never see represented in movies is the gay part of West Hollywood, like what was once called Vaseline Alley, LOL. If you've ever seen The Opposite of Sex.
Someone else's fave.
Yeah, precise. Watch out for the alleys, people. The Opposite of Sex starring Christina Ricci is this very cynical 90s only comedy, which co-stars Lisa Kudrow, but it's written by Don Ruse, who's married to Dan Bukatensky. Obviously, they're all Lisa Kudrow, him, they're all friends. Yes.
Uncoupled.
But that is one of the few movies I've seen where you're just straight up in the middle of Santa Monica Boulevard on that side of town, feeling like, oh, here's gay people walking by. Here's this gay barista. Here's that guy walking by in gym shorts, the thing you get out of the birdcage where like all these hot people are walking down the street in Miami. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that maybe at that point in time, Miami was exactly like that. To me, this is one of the few movies that, even though it's just a comedy, also happened to be slice of life for that part of LA at that time.
Other Don Roos films, who, as I said, I worked with on Uncoupled, and he is fantastic. He wrote Sing a White Female. He wrote
which is not
on the Side.
He wrote that too? My God.
Yes, he did. And also, Bounce.
Okay. Somebody had to have written it. It can't just appear itself. Single White Female, I think, is best of that genre, by the way. It really, really holds up. I think it's because you got two really awesome performances at the center of it.
When she walks in with the same haircut, that's the gag of the century.
No, I mean, it's like it turns the Vertigo scene where they recreate old Madeline into a much creepier moment. And I think it's just excellent. And also, of course, we miss Bridget Fonda. Where is she? Danny Elfman? Yeah. I want answers.
It's also from that genre of films where gay writers or gay directors would sort of use certain subcultures to make a film queer. You know, when she goes to the BDSM bar in it. I feel like whenever things like that would pop up in 90s films, it made the film a little bit more like queer and sexy. And it was something that you could actually put into a film in the 90s without having to put in gay people.
Well, it's like Party Girl, for example, has like a gayness to it, even though it's mainly about her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. West Hollywood, and then Hollywood in general. Sean Baker is having such a moment right now with Anora, but I'd be remiss not to bring up Tangerine.
Oh my God, you want to take a trip down Santa Monica Boulevard? First of all, you're gonna do it frenetically in this movie, and then secondly, the character's talking at like 500 miles per hour too. I love the yappiness of that film.
Yeah, and I am so sad that we never got more from Maya Taylor. She should have been a bigger star after that. And she won the Independent Spirit Award for Best Supporting Female.
And I remember at the time we were like arguing, oh, she should be at these roundtables with these actresses. And now it feels particularly insane that she wasn't, you know, people like that who are like emerging in that moment should be talking to these veteran actors in front of us. I want to be seeing that.
That should actually be the point of those things, because when you see someone, you know, you pair Nicole Kidman and Kate Blanchett, for instance. Have they done that?
Not that I've seen. There's actually not too many photos of those two together, now that you mention it. Remember when people were like, Nicole Kidman and Kylie Minogue have never been paired together, and we assumed, you know, they were out for
Australian
blood.
Beef.
Yes, right. Yes.
They've got kangaroo.
They've got some boomerang, if you will. Yes.
But no, I think that I would actually prefer those if it were younger, hot actors who like have just had a flashy, like a really good role paired with a veteran actor. And it's like they're both learning something.
I was going to say, because these veteran actors, they don't really need to learn anything from each other. I mean, much as it's like fun to see like Demi Moore and Angelina Jolie talk, and they did have some tender moment where they both realized that they're shy at award shows or something and they should have greeted each other. Okay, but like that could have happened off camera. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know.
In the line for the bar at the Golden Globes, that's when that combo is supposed to happen. We don't have to watch it.
Right. Let's see here. Father of the Bride, technically an L.A. movie. There's got to be some comfort viewing when it comes to L.A., and I think that might be the pinnacle of that.
Mm-hmm. This might come as an odd comfort movie because it is not a comfort watch at all once you get to the end, but I fucking love watching Boogie Nights.
Oh, sure. Well, also, he is just the master of that part of L.A. We're talking now about like, the Valley. Licorice Pizza is a similarly loving tribute to that part of L.A. Also, I was just thinking about him recently as he pertains to The Brutalist, because PTA makes movies of similar grandeur, but I think he is way more talented than Brady Corbet when it comes to bringing in the nuances of characters and turning those into exciting plot points. I would say that the characters in The Brutalist, even though it's a movie I like, is about kind of broad types in a way, or it doesn't really get into the characters, whereas PTA doesn't get through a movie unless you discover four weird things about every character.
Brady Corbett is, I've seen some his other works. Brady Corbett is a director who is more, I think, about ideas and sort of like the overall picture of the Brutalist. It's about, you know, like the architecture. It's about, you know, immigrants, et cetera. And I think that PTA, probably just from, you know, growing up in Los Angeles, is more in tune with the characters, the weird people that you interact with. I mean, the plots of a lot of his movies are sort of incidental. Like, what is the plot to Boogie Nights? You know,
Dirk
Diggler
right.
becomes a porn star, et cetera. But you meet all these interesting people along the way. Every character in a PTA film has the potential to be your favorite character.
He also just gets like the every like square foot of space in an LA locale correct. The feeling of what it's like to be next to this like desiccated pool in the valley, the way it feels to be on like a shag carpet in an old apartment, the way it feels to be comforted mm-hmm. by this weird Julianne Moore character, and where did she come from and where is she going and why is she feel like she's about to shatter in front of me. Everything is so palpable in a PTA movie, namely his LA movies.
Inherent Vice, underrated.
I saw that when it came out, and I remember not having much of an opinion about it at the time, but I will reinvestigate that.
Yeah. Speaking of another sort of frenetic film that is very tense to watch, but Nightcrawler.
Oh, I think that's one of the definitive LA movies because in the way that this movie Carry On that just came out, which is also technically an LA movie, makes a set piece of every part of the airport. Like now we're in mm-hmm. the TSA line. Now we're on the conveyor belt with all the bags, whatever. Every LA location in Nightcrawler is like vivified. Like, oh, now we're in the hills in this like, we're peering around this apartment. Now we're like down around 1st, 2nd and 3rd Street and things are exploding. You know, it has, like many great action movies, it turns every urban location into a potential for fireworks. Obviously another movie in this case is Drive, which is another very loving tribute to LA.
Yeah, Carry On, a movie that I really enjoyed, although I will say, still waiting for a movie that captures the feeling of being at LAX.
Yeah, it was very, it's sort of like a Nomadland, how it went to an Amazon factory, but everything seemed pretty rad there. It was like, it does look like LAX here, but it's not the feeling of LAX.
It was giving Bob Hope Airport.
Yeah. Things were smooth sailing, yeah.
Action movies, obviously the Beverly Hills Cop franchise, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard.
Mm. No, I mean, I hate to say it, Die Hard is just one of the few action movies where also, obviously you can be enraptured by the actual action occurring, but every character is amazing too. Like, I love even fucking Bonnie Bedelia in that movie.
Yeah, and, you know, action movies. This week, you don't really want to bring up disaster movies.
No.
But there are a lot of really good ones, you know, set in LA. And I think that there's something about the film industry and the way that they love to destroy Los Angeles in movies, mostly because it's there. But I do wonder what kind of movies will be coming out of this, you know, situation, this horrible moment in Los Angeles. I wonder how the film industry is going to respond to it. Not well, probably, because how did they respond to COVID and how did they respond to the writer's strike?
Well,
There
are also just certain things we end up not making movies about. Like, really, there were two 9/11 movies, and we do have that play Come From Away. But otherwise, from a monumental moment in U.S. history, we have just not even begun to scratch the surface on that, you know?
Girl, why do you keep forgetting September 10th?
I know I watch it every day. I get up, I get the coffee, I put on September 10th.
I say this as a joke, but legitimately, there are people who did just assume that movie is about September 11th.
Right. No, I know. Right. I mean, why would you call it September 10th otherwise? Yeah, it does seem sort of crazy. By the way, we already brought up Clueless, of course. Amy Heckerling, I think, in general, is a great LA artist. Fast Times at Ridgemont High has, in addition to 3 Best Actor Oscar winners in it, can you name all 3?
Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Yeah.
It is, actually, no, I can't. You know, I've never seen that movie.
It is Forrest Whitaker. It is Nicolas Cage and Sean Penn, in addition to many other people, including Phoebe Cates, who I guess we just don't put in movies anymore because she's married to the lovely Kevin Kline.
Well, you know, I only recently watched Dazed and Confused, so I feel like I'm missing
what
movies
was your take
from that
on
era.
That? What was your take on Dazed and Confused?
Dazed and Confused was more of a movie that I feel like I respected, that I enjoyed. It's Linklater sort of has that PTA quality of every character in it has the potential to be your favorite character. It felt very much like he was describing shit that had happened to him in life. It felt realistic. A lot of the funny moments were incredibly funny, but as a movie, it felt kind of overlong to me and just sort of was a meandering wild night. But I can understand that if it was from the time period when you grew up or you'd seen it when it first came out, that it would be a movie that just feels comforting to you and you would rewatch it all the time.
I guess before we move on, one I will bring up, and this is not a movie that I was obsessed with, but as an LA entertainment journalist, going to like junkets and interviewing people and just the sense of sort of like cynical ennui you encounter when talking to a celebrity who's done 77 interviews in a row, Sofia Coppola somewhere captured something. It's Stephen Dorff, Elle Fanning, and they're a father and daughter, and there are just so many scenes of like being bored in LA that can only come from that level of a Nepo baby. You know what I'm saying?
I'm a somewhere apologist.
Oh, you are?
I really do. Yeah, I really do enjoy that film. I love the ennui of a Sofia Coppola film. She just shows up the set and she's like, what are we going to do today?
Yeah,
I'll just turn on the camera.
And she's not going to amp it up for one degree higher than it needs to be. I mean, maybe Bling Ring was sort of a version of that. But for the most part, she really is keying into people who are just kind of downtrodden and sleepy-eyelidded and Kirsten Dunsty.
Well, you brought up Sofia Coppola. I think that I want to end this conversation by bringing up one of my favorite directors, Michael Mann, who I think does Los Angeles gorgeously. Obviously, there's Heat, but one of my favorite films from him is Collateral.
Jamie Foxx had the world's greatest year that year with Ray and Collateral.
Yeah, and also just my favorite actor, Tom Cruise, is in that movie, and that is, people always bring up Magnolia, which they should, because that's a fucking fantastic role from Tom, but his turn in Collateral is, it's intense, it's scary, it's harrowing. I think that is also one of his best performances.
I will absolutely rewatch that. I don't remember a thing about that movie.
And the ending, I think, is just sort of, like, it's beautiful, and it feels very Los Angeles.
Well, that was a whole lot of L.A. I'm actually sort of impressed with us. I didn't realize there was so much L.A. on film, frankly. We didn't even really get into La La Land, and they filmed the whole thing on the highway. How disrespectful of us.
Disrupting people's commutes.
Right. No, and also, by the way, we made Rosemary DeWitt Ryan Gosling's sister and said nothing of it. We gave her two lines. It made no sense.
I mean, and we didn't even talk about his other film, the beginning of Hollywood itself, Babylon.
Oh, well, you know what? I defend Babylon.
I
think it's a condition. I'm taking pills to curb this, but I do defend Babylon.
I loved Babylon until that Coca-Cola ad at the end of the movie.
Oh, my God. When they were like, did you know that this movie is like Singing in the Rain? And I said, yes, I was paying attention.
A better montage at the end of a film comes in Nickel Boys, by the way, which maybe just says, if you're doing montages in films, get a documentary filmmaker to do it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Anjanou Ellis-Taylor is so good in that movie. That scene where she hugs the guy who's not her son. Oh, what a lovely scene.
I would also suggest that it's available on YouTube to rent if you want to watch a long documentary about film in L.A. It's this film called Los Angeles Plays Itself. And it is a documentary that is completely just made of clips from Los Angeles films. And it gets into Los Angeles as a character. It gets into the architecture in Los Angeles. I think it's really great. The only downside is that the narrator is maybe somebody else should have done it.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So if you can get past that, fantastic documentary.
Constructive criticism. Lovely.
Where was Michelle Williams?
Right. Oh, my God. After she did the Britney thing, you would think that would be her new life. She's like our David Attenborough.
All right, when we are back, I have a conversation with Robbie Williams about his new film, A Better Man. And then after that, Lewis rejoins me for Keep It.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. Introducing Design Intelligence from Squarespace, combining two decades of industry-leading design expertise with cutting-edge AI technology to unlock your strongest creative potential. Design Intelligence empowers anyone to build a beautiful, more personalized website tailored to their unique needs and craft a bespoke digital identity to use across one's entire online presence.
Oh, you must be talking about iramadison.com, which is powered by Squarespace.
I wasn't. Oh, God. Now you've brought it up. It's a curse.
Squarespace Payments is also the easiest way to manage your payments in one place with Squarespace. Onboarding is fast and it's simple. You can get started in just a few clicks and start receiving payments right away. Plus, give your customers more ways to pay with popular payment methods like Klarna, ACH Direct Debit, Apple Pay, Afterpay, and Clearpay. Connect major social and multimedia accounts to your website in a few clicks as icons, direct links, or embedded feeds. Build visitor trust while updating content only where you need it, extending your brand's footprint. Sellers can also sync their product catalog directly with Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Google to reach more customers and reduce the steps for a purchase.
Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/keepit to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/keepit.
From his time as a boy bander in the UK group Take That to an incredible solo career marked by hits like Angels and She's the One, this week's guest has sealed his legacy as British pop royalty. His career is so storied, in fact, it inspired Better Man, Michael Gracey's new musical biopic with a simian twist. Here to discuss the film and his life that inspired it, please welcome to Keep It, Robbie Williams.
Preach. Thank you for that intro, and I must say I deserve it.
Well, I do have a quibble before we get into all of it.
Let's go.
I'm an American, and our big song of yours is Millennium, and it's nowhere to be found in the movie.
It really isn't, is it? It must have... Here's the thing, right? So people quite often in interviews ask me, hey, you must be bored or don't like one of your songs. What song is that? And then I say Millennium because that's true. And then they go, oh, and then they look at me almost perplexed and angry. But A, you asked the question, and B, if I'd have said a song that you'd agreed with me about and just nodded, how would that make me feel? Like, yeah, oh, you agree that one's crap, do you? Anyway, Millennium... Had
I'm
no
not
place.
Perplexed, by the way. I'm like a Madonna fan, so I know that she never plays songs that we want to hear.
What does she not like?
She, like, for the longest time, I think once the Frozen, like, world tour started, she didn't play any of her earlier stuff at all.
And you know, she's completely wrong, because as a fan... All of the, most of her stuff actually throughout her career is stellar, but especially the early stuff that she probably doesn't like, because I love that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you were saying about Millennium.
Oh, yeah, Millennium. I was just saying I don't like it. That's why it's not in the movie.
Speaking of the movie, I really did enjoy this quite a bit, and I... want to know, I guess, you know, how you came to meet with Michael Gracey and come up with the idea of the film. I know that you said, you know, many times that, you know, you feel like a monkey when you perform. And so he sort of went with that idea. But how did this all come together?
First of all, can I put your quote on a poster? I really enjoyed this quite a bit. I think
yes.
That's valid. Yeah. So I met Michael through his lawyer. His lawyer is the dad of my wife's childhood best friend. That's how we met. And we became friends at a party. And then one day, Michael phoned me up and said, I need to come and ask a favour. And he came round to my house and we sat down and he said, look, I'm doing this film called The Greatest Showman. And instantly I thought he's going to ask me to be the lead in it because I am the greatest showman. And he played me songs and he's like, look out, because here I come. And I'm like, that's amazing. This is me. All of them. And I'm like, yes, yes, tick, tick, tick. Sign me up. Of course I'll do this. Then he showed me the storyboards and showed me the costumes. And I got more excited and more excited. And I was just like, cut all this. Ask me the question. Where do I sign? I'm in. And he said, and now here's the question. Here's the favour that I want you to do. And I'm like, anything. He said, will you get hold of Hugh Jackman and convince him to be the lead in the movie? Crestfallen. I think that should be my autobiography title, Crestfallen. Or Born to Crabs.
So you met that way, and then you came up with the idea for, basically, how was the back and forth on this film, I guess? You're telling him stories about your life.
I told him stories about my life for 20 hours over a matter of months, and then the back and forth stopped. And Michael Gracie, the genius director, went off and made this movie. I had no notes. I didn't even know I could have notes, to be honest with you. I'm such a really good English polite pupil. Whatever's good, thank you. I have whatever served. As it happens, you know, this film is touching people on such a profound level that I'm very lucky and smart in one way to have no notes and get out of its way and my way.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think for a lot of people, when they make a biopic, especially people who are still alive for them, there's always the concern that it's not going to be very truthful. You know, it's not going to show them completely as a three-dimensional character. Were there any stories that you were afraid to tell him? Were there any things that you saw in the film that sort of it was hard to rewatch, even with a monkey playing you?
Yeah, a lot of it was hard to rewatch because it's the greatest hits of my trauma and grief for the TikTok generation, you know, and that has an effect. That being said, I overshare. It's what I do professionally. It's also it's how I socialize. I'm scared of small talk. It's like being in a headlock. And so I don't want to talk about the weather. I don't want to talk about things that don't matter. I want to talk about things that really matter to you and matter to me. And that's my trauma and your trauma. And I want to bond with you. I don't want to have a surface relationship with anybody, including myself and the world.
Mm-hmm.
I just said something profound.
A little bit.
Yeah. I'm pleased with myself.
I was watching your Graham Norton appearance, and I came to the conclusion that, yes, you're a great storyteller. And I was wondering when you first noticed this ability about yourself, you know, because writing, it took you a while to realize that you loved your lyrics. But what about telling stories?
I still don't. Actually, it comes from being on chat shows and being so nervous and terrified that when it came to promoting albums, I realized that I'd be going on chat shows and stuff, that I actually once went and checked myself into a tropical disease hospital thinking I'd contracted something by recently being in Mexico and Sri Lanka. And what it was actually anxiety about having to talk about myself on TV. So I researched myself and figured out a plan of what I was going to say and how I was going to say it. And then it went so well, and people tell me or have spoken about me as a really good chat show guest that is a good raconteur. And it all comes from being terrified. But people have, I'm saying this like it's my knowledge. People have pointed this out to me, so I understand this to be true. And when people tell you a nice thing about yourself, it gives you the impetus to grow on that and expand on that. So thank you for the people that noticed.
Was it a thing that you really noticed from early being on talk shows, or was it something that you noticed also earlier in your life, you know, talking to people? I mean, because you say you don't like small talk. Was it something that came out of high school, being interacting with fans, et cetera?
No. I know that how I present myself is unusual. And I know that my raison d'être is to entertain with the meager talents that I have. And when I'm doing an interview, I want it to be memorable. When I'm doing an interview, I want to win. I'm also competitive. And I also realize that I'm in an entertainment industry where most people are vanilla and have no personality. So if they're not going to do it, I might as well. Plus, it also comes from a place of not being very good at the job that I've been given. You know, I'm all right, but I'm really good at showing off. I'm better at showing off than I am at melodies and lyrics and writing songs. But, you know, you can't quantify that. They don't give awards for showing off.
They do. If you'd gotten cast in Greatest Showman, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, speaking even of people who have very sort of interesting personalities who are in the film, I was actually shocked to see, you know, a lot of the stuff about Liam Gallagher in the film. And my question, I guess, was what was your relationship with him like at the time? And also, was Noel also involved and just didn't want to be in the film? Or were you actually closer with just Liam?
Liam and Noel are in that scene together.
Yes, but Liam, I feel like, only talks the most, and you reference him the most.
Yeah, which is not my choice. You know, once again, okay. I got out of the way and let Michael Gracie do his thing. But what was my relationship with him? I was in a Lily White pop band that were considered, you know, Lily White and clean. And I wasn't that. I wasn't the music that I was singing, and I wasn't who I was representing myself as, so it felt inauthentic. What felt authentic to me was people that were hedonistic and breaking the law and rallying against social norms and being unusual and provoking and being controversial for being controversial's sake. So I looked up to Oasis straight away and wished that I was in that band doing that. That was my relationship.
Did you ever consider, when you were making music and especially when you were going solo post Take That, trying to make that type of music?
I did try unsuccessfully. You know, what happens is I open my mouth and my brain and my spirit and pop comes out. I can't help it. You know, it's like I'm a theater musical kid who's cabaret and jazz hands. And, you know, as much as I wanted to write Karma Police by Radiohead, I wrote Karma Chameleon by Culture Club instead, which is also an incredible song. There's nothing wrong with that song. It's beautiful, but it's not what I set out to do.
Mm-hmm. And how, I guess, do you find a way to, I guess, reconcile that with yourself? Do you listen to a lot of that music still? Is there still some part of you that wishes that you could write something like that?
Nah, I'm over that. You know, the need and want to be cool is a young man's game and a young man's want and need. What I need to do now is to facilitate a life and a lifestyle for my family that none of the centuries of Williams before me ever had. And by all means necessary, I will do that. That becomes my MO. That becomes my raison d'être. That becomes the most important thing in my life, is prolonging this thing, seeing how far I can take it. Mm-hmm. But it's not to be cool. And also, we live in a day and age now where cool doesn't exist, not in the same way that it did in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and definitely the 90s. You know, and thank God. Cool people are wankers.
In the film, there's a moment where, and I'm sure this is Michael Gracie, you know, coming up with an arc for you, but it talks a bit about making music post Take That. And one of the interesting things that, you know, he has your character say is, you know, you were focusing sort of on revenge in a way of proving yourself to Gary, to the band members, to people who doubted you, etc. I'm interested in what your music sort of what your method of making music was post that, you know, after you reconciled with Gary, after you dealt with your sobriety. What was it like that compelled you to make music then?
It was completely about survival. And, you know, everything that I do and everything that I have done, every performance that I give and every interview that I do it like my life depends on it, because it does. And my life has revolved around self-sabotage and chaos and self-hatred and self-loathing and being loathed by great swathes of the general public. And, you know, they are and have been more of a fuel than they will ever know. Most, I'd say 98% of the stuff that I have and I've achieved because I've read and heard those words. And I would like to thank them personally for that fuel. But also, you know, I haven't liked myself and I haven't believed that I can do any of this. So everything that I do is built on anxiety and is built on a fractured sense of self and a complicated inner life.
Mm-hmm. I think that was actually one of the things that really made the biopic beautiful to me. You know, it entered your mind in a way that was very relatable for myself as a writer. And also a lot of the stuff with your father in that was very relatable as well. So it did actually touch me quite a bit.
Thank you.
Putting that on.
Yeah, it's unusual. How old are you?
38.
Okay. So you're still in the cusp of coming from the generation before us that were literally from another world. Emotionally and physically, the generation gone before us and the generation before them may have well have been from the dark ages when it comes to do with anything to do with the mind and the psyche and the wants and the needs of emotional and sensitive people. So it's very, very interesting to me to now live in a time where at the front of social discourse is mental health and mental illness. Mm-hmm. And this film speaks to that, where we were, who we were, and who we are now. And what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. And I don't know, it's also watching, you know, a film like this and thinking about, you know, drug use and musicians and how now there's, you know, so many artists who are one, either sober and very open about it, or they are, you know, they speak about using, you know, ketamine or cocaine or other things, you know, casually in ways that don't seem very, you know, detrimental. You know, they're not hiding it. It's not some sort of rock star persona. They're just sort of doing it to have fun.
Do they? I mean, what, like, you mean actively doing stuff?
Yeah.
Is that what you're
saying? I live in New York.
Okay, so I'm not in of that world, and I'm mm-hmm. not au fait when it comes to new artists, how they present themselves mm-hmm. and what they talk about. But I also think that it's not unusual. People say, why is it the musicians and why is it the da-da-da? Well, they're all and entertainers, they're all sensitive people seeking validation from the outside world because of the complicated lives that they had when they were growing up. So for me, when I did cocaine, because I've got ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, and I have social anxiety, when I did cocaine, it's street Adderall. No wonder I loved it. It was the first time that I could concentrate and converse with people, you know. So there is a sensitivity to the people that are in my line of work that leads it to self-medication. And you're looking to heal yourself by confessing yourself to the world and wanting to be seen and be heard on such a level that will obviously never fill the hole. Therefore, medicating yourself on drink and drugs.
I have one last thing for you before you go. I'm a fan of your album, Sing When You're Winning. And I had a question about how the cover of the Frank and Nancy Sinatra song Something Stupid came along with Nicole Kidman.
Well, first of all, I love that song. Second of all, Nicole Kidman thankfully said yes when I asked her. And it was a wonderful moment, you know, a wonderful moment that somebody so statuesque and beautiful and important in the entertainment industry felt the need and want to reciprocate my request with a yes. You know, I'm very grateful. She's a lovely person and a great moment in my career.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. Continued success. You look after yourself.
Thank you. And this might be like a random comment too, but your wife, I really loved her in Days of Our Lives. I watched that show with my grandmother, and I still watch it to this day. I have friends on it. So
let me tell you this, right? Very quickly. She auditioned as an Italian person for two shows, right?
Yeah.
So she speaks Italian. She went in as an Italian, got the job as an Italian, spoke to the makeup people, the producers, the directors as an Italian. Everybody thought she was an Italian. Then they decided to keep her on the show and elongate her part. And by that time, she was balls deep into a huge lie that she couldn't go back on. 3 months into being on the show, she had to come out as an American from Coldwater Canyon. It was a proper Tootsie-style story.
Coming up next, Keep It.
Crooked's friends at Vote Save America Action and Crooked Ideas have set up a disaster relief fund to benefit those impacted by the horrific wildfires here in LA. It is super easy for you to make one donation that's split among incredible charities doing critical work for our neighbors and first responders. The Latino Community Foundation, Los Angeles Regional Food Bank, Los Angeles Fire Department Foundation, United Way of Greater Los Angeles, California Community Foundation Wildfire Relief Fund.
So thanks to you, we all have raised nearly $100,000 for these great groups so far. Learn more and make a tax-deductible donation at votesofamerica.com/relief. And we are back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Although the LA segment was one of my favorites in a while. So
we got a lot to live up to. Yeah. No, it's like we were driving through LA, frankly.
Yeah. Well, speaking of driving.
Oh, God. Yes.
I noticed my car had been vandalized in the parking lot. And I was like, who could have done that? Carrie Underwood?
Which reminds me of my Keep It. It's almost as if I briefed you about this ahead of time. My Keep It this week is to Carrie Underwood, the winner of the 4th season of American Idol. So sorry, Vonzel Solomon. She is performing at the Trump inauguration. Now, of course, it doesn't really blow my mind that Carrie Underwood might have been a Trump voter or at least cool with performing for Trump. Correct me if I'm wrong here. There is absolutely no reason for her to be performing at this ceremony. This is somebody who is now a panelist on American Idol, and I know she's not making Katy Perry money yet, but she's probably making $10 million for this season or whatever. So it's not like a money thing, and I do wonder if the Trumps are like throwing the money at Carrie Underwood. That's sort of on my mind. But she's literally performing alongside The Village People and Lee Greenwood. Carrie, can you hear that this sucks? Use your amazing pitch to hear that this is so awful. What is wrong with you? Also, I know this from having friends personally who are huge fans of Carrie Underwood. This is somebody with like a serious gay following too. Why would you jeopardize all of these, like, I'll say your most ardent fans mm-hmm. for this one day where you're performing, I'm guessing, with Three Doors Down, who are Three Doors Down from hell.
Also, to go from having a song a few years ago called Love Wins.
Oh, God. And does it ever.
To team up with the bitch who wants love to lose.
Bitch. She's performing America the Beautiful, too, so it's, like, extra cringy. It's just so wretched. Again, it's like, it makes me think liberals really needed to band together and vote for fucking Bo Bice. We really had a chance there, and we didn't
it's
take advantage.
It's not shocking. It's not shocking, you know, but, you know, I expected her to stay Carrie underhanded. I didn't think she'd be so overt right. about it, you know? Yeah. It reminds me of when I was doing research on the Bush administration for my book, I recalled that Destiny's Child performed at Bush's inauguration.
Oh, but, that's wild. Yeah.
Right. But I get it. He was the governor of their home state, you know, and it was early on in their career. So what are you going to do? Turn this down?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that would have been like 2000, literally.
Yeah, it was 2000. Okay. Yeah. You know, they were surviving.
They hadn't even gotten to that part yet. They were not even jumping. They were MCI was cutting their phone bill or whatever at that time.
That's what the press conference in Independent Woman was about. When they said question, the reporters were like, "Now why were you performing at that inauguration?"
Tell me what you think about this being a traitor.
I don't know. I'm this saddens me, especially because the bar Flaming Saddles in Hell's Kitchen, which I love going to on a Sunday sometimes with my Broadway friends, because they Mondays are dark on Broadway, so you usually get to have a fun night
wild.
On a Sunday. They sure do. I love putting Carrie Underwood on that fucking jukebox, because the majority of the music there is country music, obviously. Yeah. Truly, you go to the jukebox and try to play Charlie XCX, not there.
No, right. No.
But yeah, I love putting on, you know, Cowboy Casanova, which used to be one of my favorite karaoke songs.
I like the Cara DioGuardi written song Undo It by Carrie Underwood. But it must be said right now, I'll add this to the keep it, Jesus Take the Wheel has always sucked. It's a phrase that caught on. The song is bad.
Imagine you get into a car crash and they ask you, what were you doing? Well, I let Jesus take the wheel.
Right. And maybe that holds up in court. I don't even actually know how the system, like she's from Oklahoma or something, right? Maybe that holds up down there.
Didn't work for Karen Huger.
Ira, what is your keep it this week?
Well, speaking of the Housewives,
yes,
Traitors is back.
It sure is. I saw all three episodes when I was hanging out in San Diego.
Yeah, and my keep it does not go to, spoiler alert, Dorinda Medley being one of the first people offed on the series. It's very disappointing that we would not get to see, you know, more of one of my favorite housewives on the show, just being crazy and unhinged at the round table, especially because, one, people were imagining that she could be a traitor just because of how she was attacking people immediately. And I wanted to let them know, baby, that's just Dorinda. And she's not even drunk here.
No, this is her in her right mind, just like kind of scat singing, yelling at everybody.
No, my real keep it, though, is connected to her being killed. And it is the fact that I'm starting to think that Big Brother players are just bad at traitors.
It's interesting. Oh, you're talking about Danielle Reyes now.
I'm talking about Danielle Reyes, who is an icon to me in Big Brother, the best player to never win. And then last season, we had Dan, who was truly my favorite Big Brother player. But I think that the skills required to win Big Brother are not the skills that you need for the traitors.
And what do you mean? Because I do feel like among the reality shows, I at least intuitively connect these two in my head, because it's about fooling people. It's about diplomacy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Dan played the game very under the radar.
We're talking about Dan Giesling, who's like the most vaunted player in Big Brother history. Yes.
Yeah. Dan Giesling played the game under the radar. And in Traders, people started suspecting that he was one because he wasn't throwing out options of who he thought a trader could be. Weirdly, in this game, you really just sort of have to like say a name and like stick at it like a dog with a fucking bone. Otherwise, people think that you're a trader. It's because there's always someone that's saying at the round table, well, who do you think is a trader? And the traders usually fail when they don't have an option. They just sort of go, well, I'm waiting to hear what other people say. No, that's a mistake. And then Danielle isn't doing that, but the people she's killing, she's not smartly thinking about it because Dorinda, people thought that she was a traitor. So it did not make sense to kill her. You keep her around as a shield. And I think that survivor players are sort of more equipped to keeping people around in the game as shields, which is why when Rob became a traitor and joined them, he cleaned that shit up. And, you know, I saw that he was angry at having to get rid of Tony, but, you know, like, he knows at least instinctively how to play the game a bit better.
I will say, though, I was a bit disappointed when this, we're talking about Boston Rob from Survivor, legendary Survivor player, came in and was named one of the traitors along with the three other traitors who include Bob the Drag Queen, Danielle Reyes, and then what's the other woman's name?
Carolyn Weiger from Survivor.
Yes, she's 46. Also named. I have to say, when the trio without Bob were the traitors, I thought that was pretty fabulous. I thought the three of them had like a potentially rad vibe going. And then Boston Rob comes in. He goes, I was so disappointed to see these three people I was working with. I was like, we were having a good time a second ago. And two, do you just mean it's a gay guy and two women? Is that what you mean?
Well, I think he meant it mostly in that Bob, everyone in the house already thinks he's a traitor. I think that Bob is the one who's going to get caught first. And I think that he meant that mostly because he did have to sort of out himself even more as a potential traitor by getting Tony out. Because if he hadn't gotten Tony out at that round table, Bob was probably going to go home.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he certainly was. He reacted very, very defensively, which if it works on occasion, I think that can sort of propel you through the game. But in this case, it just seemed like he was about to burst into tears for no reason.
Yeah, I will say that I think that Rob and Carolyn teaming up will kind of be iconic because she seems like the one who's best equipped to be a traitor. She's kooky, you know, and she played up her kookiness.
Yeah, she's also like believably emotional and not over the top, you know.
Yeah. Danielle, for instance, like the crying in the morning. What are you doing all that, girl? Less theatrics. I will say that Tony, when he left, we've always talked about the rules of this game and sort of how it's scattershot, you know, how you win or whatever. He said that in an interview when he left, I believe at Entertainment Weekly, that the game is pretty much, let's guess who Alan picked as traitors, you know?
Right.
That's what the game is. And he wishes that they would have consequences if you get it wrong. Because going in there, you don't care. You form an alliance and you just vote everybody off. There's no consequence whether they're a traitor or not. I wish they would be like, hey guys, you get it wrong, you're up for murder tonight. But if you get a traitor out, you're safe. And it gives you an incentive to try to actually really want to get a traitor out. Because they never would have voted me out if that was the case, because they knew I was not the traitor. But they were just like, okay, this guy's deceptive. We can't trust him. Let's get him out, traitor or not.
Well, again, this points to the thing I am most fascinated about with this show, which is I think it's entertaining based on the personalities in it, but it is not a good game. And I feel like as the seasons go on, there will be changes and tweaks made to the game that will probably improve it. And I look forward to how they navigate that. Because again, also, we're still in this universe where we're watching them do physical challenges that have no ramifications for the game. You know, they added one a little wrinkle recently, but like they need more of things. They need more things like that.
Yeah, I will say the challenges this season have been very fun to watch because they, you know, not just the adding of the shields, the thing of like who's deciding like if they're going to not be up for murder, etc. I'm watching the challenges more this season. And also Traitors UK season 3 is fantastic.
No, I need like a VPN to watch that though, don't I?
You do.
What the fuck is that? Didn't we strike a deal? Wasn't this going to be on Peacock?
Baby, just go to ExpressVPN. It's like $9 a month.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was that easy.
Money.
I'll look at the old checkbook. We'll see what there's room for.
Also, to lastly say, speaking of games, I've been watching Pop Culture Jeopardy, and I really enjoy it.
Oh, I mean, I will say about this. I was skeptical about having three people on a team for Pop Culture Jeopardy, but really, the breadth of material, you need teammates for this. Like, I know I'm obviously a movies, TV, music guy. I do not know much about TikTok. I do not know much about sports as they pertain to pop culture. So, like, having a team of three people really makes a lot of sense for the show, and the teams are very impressive.
Yeah, I will also say that maybe you knew a lot more people on the original Jeopardy because you're immersed in that King's Gambit.
Yes.
Of Jeopardy players.
Trebekistan, yes.
Yes, but the people in this are more like pub trivia people, and I was shocked at how many people I knew.
Oh, yeah, no.
Playing Pop Culture Jeopardy.
I think also demographically it's our people, too. It's a lot of 30 to 45, so.
Yeah, and there's a lot more faggots.
Oh, quite. I mean, there's a reason people online are calling it Gay Jeopardy. Yeah.
All right. Thank you to Robbie Williams for joining me this week. And if you're in Los Angeles, try to stay safe.
And we will see you next week on Keep It.
Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.